Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the February episode of City Talks. This month, we're focusing on the government's recently released green paper, Building Our Industrial Strategy, and what it will mean for UK cities. Before we get to that, I'm joined by my colleagues Alexander Jones and Paul Sweeney to discuss the biggest political developments of the past month. Alex, let's turn to an update on Brexit and the issues of trade and cities. Just give us a sense as to where we are now.
Well, obviously, at the moment, the Commons is voting about Article 50 and whether to pass it. So Brexit is everywhere, as it will be all year. But I think what's striking is people are talking not just about the process of Article 50, but actually negotiations. What's the deal going to look like? What kind of deal are we going to get with the US? President Trump, obviously in the news a great deal in the past month for various decisions he's taken. So I think that that discussion about the terms of trade, who are we going to get deals with, what will those deals look like, will only increase. And that's where I think the cities discussion is so important. And where we published Cities Outlook, we had the big focus this year on where do exports go? Because actually what's striking about discussions is they're very national. They're all about where do we trade with nationally. But what we found in Outlook is where cities trade with looks quite different. So a big picture is the biggest market is the EU. Getting a deal with the EU is vital for economic growth across the country. And then what's interesting is quite how much dependence on the EU varies.
Yeah.
From Exeter, 70% dependent. But even Derby, the least dependent, a quarter of its exports go to the EU. So I think a real conversation that needs to be had now about the geography of the deals and how they'll affect different places.
Yeah. So Paul, just unpack that a little bit more. Give us some of the headlines of on Cities Outlook in terms of cities and the significance of different industries for different places and the implications for deals or trade deals that we may or may not get.
Well, I've looked at a number of things, looked at how much places trade, where they sell it to, and actually what do they trade as well. I think in terms of how much they trade, we see that Sunderland was top, £40,000 of exports for every job in the city, and that was top by quite some distance as well. But that brings us into the element of what places trade as well, because in Sunderland, it was almost 80% of their exports were from a car manufacturer, particularly Nissan. Sunderland was one of the seven places that actually had a really big reliance on one single industry for their exports, which is a bit of a challenge for them. You know, it's great they're exporting a lot, but actually having your eggs all in one basket, what does that mean in terms of diversity in the future? And the third thing was obviously, as Alex has mentioned, the geography of this too. You know, in general, 46% of all city exports go to the EU, by far the largest market. That's three times larger than what goes to the US. Then you see variation across cities as well. Exeter is the most reliant, 70%, and Derby is the least reliant at 25%. But still, 25% is a lot of goods and services going over the channel.
And I think that's what's interesting about the debate at the moment. Theresa May obviously cozying up to President Trump. That's good, but 15% of exports go to the US. It's not as big a market as the EU, so it's all very well getting a deal with the United States. We should look to expand there. But if we don't get a deal with the EU, it's going to affect far more places across the country. It will be really important for the future that we do get a good deal. Yeah.
And obviously there are politics of the trade deal, and particularly, you know, we were talking about some of these places that are very reliant on one or two industries. You can see the demand for places, you know, for those places to get deals being quite significant. Alex?
Absolutely. So if you look at areas like, well, the car industry, and actually Sunderland is very dependent on the EU for its trade. So it's not just one industry, but it's going more primarily to the EU. Yeah. So there'll be kind of big pressure there. I think generally, though, what's interesting is most places don't depend on one sector. They depend on lots of sectors, and their biggest market is the EU. So this isn't just about getting a deal in one sector with the EU. This has got to be about getting a deal across lots of sectors with the EU. If you're really going to help get a country that works for all and economic growth across the piece.
Okay. And part of the story that we were highlighting in Outlook is obviously a focus on, rightly a focus on, the trade deal and the nature of the trade deal that the UK government can strike. But one of the other important reminders, in a sense, is that there are other things to be done from a more domestic perspective about creating conditions in more places so more firms are more competitive, they're able to trade internationally with
the Europe, but also with the US and other parts of the globe. And that touches a little bit on the industrial strategy. So Alex, just give us a quick headline on the industrial strategy, what it was, the outline of it, and then we can have a reflection on what we thought from a Centre for Cities point of view.
Sure. So the industrial strategy, published a couple of weeks ago, set out 10 pillars for boosting economic growth across the country. And many of them were thematic around skills, around supporting businesses, and then there were a couple that were much more about places. So specifically supporting places to grow and on institutions in places. Mm. I think what was striking about it was it talked about some of those big themes that you often see in industrial strategies. It had sector deals, which we expected to see, mm-hmm. but very much focused on five sectors.
Yeah.
They talked a lot about having a place-based industrial strategy before it was published. I think actually on reading it, it was certainly there, more than it has been in other strategies, but not as much as we expected. So certainly touching all the buttons on skills and infrastructure and supporting business that we'd hope, but I think some big questions remain about, is it really a place-based industrial strategy, yeah. as well as one that looks at supporting business across the country, and will it really help the different places to grow?
That certainly was a tension ball, wasn't it? And so you could see it in the various ways that the issues were described and some of the thinking around how do we support the frontiers of the economy, those places that are productive, those firms that are very productive, to do more, but also how do we then weave in those places and those industries that are struggling and how can we get more out of those sorts of things? A big question that the answers are not, you know, they're not easy, are they?
And I think it's interesting in terms of the shift that we've seen from Greg Clark talking very much about a place-based industrial strategy towards what we've got in the 10 pillars, that the reality is, I think if you're a big sort of machine like central government, it makes more sense across different departments to be thinking about 10 pillars and how sort of exports, productivity and other things that have in their skills, for example. And think about it in that sense, that siloed sense, rather than actually let's go down those places and then go back from there. I think if it's down the places themselves, I think that we start to take sort of the framework that's being set out and go, actually, you know what, across these 10 pillars, how do they play out here? And, you know, it's not... It's just impossible for government to go in and go, well, actually, the industrial policy for Manchester is this, for Birmingham it's this, for somewhere else it's this. I think invariably they are going to take that step back. And I think now it's about cities themselves going, well, that's great. You've sort of presented us with a toolbox. How do we then take that and how do we then apply that to make our own sort of industrial strategy? Because as we keep on saying, these things play out very differently across the country. The challenges and opportunities in Manchester are different to Birmingham, different to Newcastle. And that's the same for an industrial strategy. It is as it is for a productivity plan, as it is for whatever else you might be able to be talking about.
I mean, I think, yeah, a couple of big tensions in the strategy. One is about that kind of place-based. How do you bring together the mix of things that genuinely helps firms to grow? Been striking that businesses have been saying, look, sort out the skills, sort out the infrastructure, get out of the way, government. You know, many of the big firms have said that's what matters, and that's place-based. Places can mix together the institutions, the ideas, the innovation and science that make the economy grow. So I think thinking much more, not just about the national approach, but about how places bring the mix together. There's a tension there that hasn't been resolved. There's also a tension, as you said, Andrew, between do you boost the fast-growing places? Mm. Or do you make sure it's a country that works for all and tackle some of the places that are lagging behind? Do you invest in guaranteed growth or potential growth? And I think clearly we want an economy that makes the most of the big cities outside London. But I think there's some very real decisions that need to be made to make sure we are making the most of London and Cambridge and Oxford. But we are investing in Manchester and Leeds city regions to make sure they are going to grow in the future. This is, you know, a strategy not just for now, but for 20 years.
Yeah. We spend a lot of money in these places as well already. And I think there's an element, particularly around skills, where it's not spent as well as what it could be. I think trying to understand better what works, particularly in skills policy, is going to be really, really important. So I think some of this is, have you got choices to make between places? You always have an implicit choice to make between places. But a lot of money is already being spent. And has been spent in places that aren't doing very well, and that money isn't having much of an impact. I think really what we need to be thinking about is if we're going to have a place-based industrial strategy, what does that look like for place X that isn't doing very well, where there's already a lot of money being spent but it's not having the impact that we wanted to have?
And I suppose what's interesting in some respects maybe connects to the latest government announcement on with the housing white paper. When you look at the industrial strategy and the 10 pillars, obviously they cover the broad, you know, broad ground, but interestingly in some respects, you know, our work in cities and on the ground, you know, some of the more fundamental things that impact on the economy weren't covered issues like housing, for example, which we know, you know, for many, or for many cities, that's they're probably their number one inhibitor to furthering economic growth. It's not innovation, it's not skills, it's not even, you know, transport infrastructure. It's simply, you know, having enough places, houses for people to live with you know, at a reasonable price. So it's kind of interesting there, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Cambridge employers put housing as number one on their list of concerns about staying in the area and expanding in the area. I mean, I think the housing white paper, there were some good measures, you know, getting developers building homes more quickly, good to see much more of an emphasis on the rental market, good to see to see that local authorities are going to be unable to tackle some of these housing stuff. Some good measures, but actually, it was a national strategy. It was one that, again, didn't think about different housing markets. Because actually, Greenbelt, yet again, pretty much ruled out, you know, not support from the government for local authorities to take decisions about building on the Greenbelt. But actually, you can't rule it out. In places like Cambridge and London, you have to have it as one of the options because there is simply not enough brownfield land to meet the demand for houses. And the more the government makes it very difficult for local places to do this, the harder it is actually to deal with those local politics. Yeah. But the fact is we need to make sure Greenbelt is one of those options.
And this is about aligning national ambitions with local ambitions, in a sense, yes, we want national government to send signals that the Greenbelt is not sacrosanct and we should be thinking about that as part of the solution. Yeah. It's not the only solution, it's part of the solution. We need our local politicians, whether they're the, you know, the new to the soon to have mayors or the existing council leaders, they also need to step up and tackle those sorts of issues as well, don't they?
Yeah, well, I think it would be much more helpful to have cover from national government with a lot of this stuff. Clearly, local politics is very difficult, especially when you're wanting to be directly elected from sort of the people in that area. But I think we do need to have a much stronger and more sensible conversation about the Greenbelt. Not all of it is green and pleasant. When the media cover stories like this, they tend to go to the middle of nowhere and go and sort of do these huge panning shots of beautiful countryside, and yet nobody's actually talking about building these areas, and it really doesn't help the debate. So I think, you know, having some people who are brave enough, I think, to put their heads above the parapet and talk about this is going to be really, really important. Of course, it's easy for us to say that, and we're not the ones who are looking to be elected. So I'm not entirely sure how you try and break that, but that is what is required, I think, to try and take this forward.
But I think it is changing that conversation. You know, we're talking about building 1, 2, 3% of the Greenbelt amongst many options around transport nodes to make sure that young people, hardworking families can actually get houses that are a price they can afford.
Yeah.
I think changing the conversation will be a big part of this. I think we'd like to see government do more on that, but we'll certainly be trying to do our bit.
Yeah, and a final thought, I suppose, from you, Alex, on, you know, we're less now than a few months till we get our metro mayors, long-heralded metro mayors. What's their role going to be in industrial strategy, in pursuing the pushing forward the housing white paper? What do we want them to be doing?
I think two things. One is they should have a vision for the local area that they are making sure local people understand and can back. And that should be a vision that's thinking about how do you boost economic growth in a way that works for as many people as possible. That's got to be about housing in many of the areas that are going to have mayors. It's got to be about skills, innovation, how you bring it all together, how you make sure people living in the more deprived areas get the skills they need to access more jobs. So there's a local people thing. There's also a national government representation. I think that's about influencing how the productivity fund gets spent, making sure they're pushing on the industrial strategy, making sure they're saying this housing white paper's national, what about the local? And it may be them doing that national pitch, which is partly to Whitehall, it's also to the world, to international, because actually there's many investors that would be interested in investing in Manchester. They're already doing it. In fact, the mayor should be making the most of their role to set out their pitch locally, nationally and internationally to kind of get this pulling together as a place, because that's what they can do.
It's sort of, what's the plan that I want to implement? What have I got powers over already? What has government put on the table that I can get hold of, like the productivity fund? And then actually, what have I not got hold of that the government hasn't put an offer that I want to have further conversations about?
And what does that mean for people? Because I think a big part of this has got to be the communication and selling this to people at all levels, but particularly local people.
Yeah.
My thanks to Alex and Paul. Thank you very much. In January, the government released its green paper entitled Building Our Industrial Strategy, which has 10 pillars and an overarching objective to improve living standards and economic growth by increasing productivity and driving growth across the whole country. My guests to discuss the contents of the industrial strategy, why the UK needs one, and what it should focus on are
the Right Honourable Sir Vince Cable, former MP and Secretary of State for Business in the Coalition Government, Gavin Kelly, Chief Executive of the Resolution Trust, and Louise Marston, Director of Innovation Policy at Nesta.
So Vince, starting with you, can you just set out what an industrial strategy is? And I suppose, how does it differ from the normal activities that government is doing to support business and enterprise?
Yeah, well, we're not, I think, starting from year zero. This is a kind of evolutionary process. I mean, there is an industrial strategy, it's ongoing. I mean, when I came into office, there was a whole set of things which Gordon Brown's government, Peter Manson in particular, had started, you know, automotive council, things of that kind. The natural instinct of my government was to walk away from all of that, but there was a series of happenings which made us take the view that we should actually build on it rather than destroy it. Mm. And just to describe them, I had a visit from all the heads of the British aerospace companies, all six of them, saying, look, the British aerospace industry is dying because you're not investing in R&D, and you know the government has got to do something as well as the private sector. We had the issues around Thameslink railway procurement, which went to Siemens rather than Bombardier in Derby. And it was probably the right decision, but it was just a kind of random public procurement decision that had massive ramifications for the supply chain. So I persuaded Cameron, with the help of people like Michael Heseltine, that we had to be more proactive. And the way we defined industrial strategy was, first of all, we need, first of all, long-term decision-making in some key areas, because if you're dealing with the car industry, the airspace industry, pharmaceuticals, and of course a lot of infrastructure, you need to think 10, 20, 30 years ahead. You can't just do these things on the spur of the moment. So you need long-term decision-making. And secondly, there are major market failures in innovation, training, particularly, but also in the supply of finance, long-term patient capital. And unless the government intervenes, these things will just fester. So we launched what we called the industrial strategy back in 2011, and it had two main elements. One were what you've just described, a kind of ordinary good policy, for want of a better word, horizontal policies, promoting apprenticeships, which we did on quite a big scale. Trying to sort out problems of long-term financing. I've set up the British Business Bank, the Green Investment Bank, things of that kind. Trying to promote innovation, which Britain hasn't been very good at, as opposed to science. That's why we set up the Caterpillar Network. So there were these kind of horizontal type policies. Mm-hmm. But we also were very clear that you have to engage with people at a sectoral level, because that's how business is organised. I mean, there are messy boundaries when you think about things like ICT, but you know the aerospace industry is reasonably discreet, the car industry, the creative industry is reasonably discreet. So we started off with 11, we finished up with 14, 15 sectors, and I would chair them, or another minister would chair them. We'd meet regularly, identify the key policy failures in their industries, and try to deal with them, and some of them were very productive. The car industry, we put up £1 billion, the industry put up £1 billion for the next generation of engines. Aerospace, similar scale, developing the new generation of wings. We had very, very good activity around creative industries, which is a very heterogeneous and sort of slightly scratchy kind of sector, but once they realised that we could help them getting flows of finance, because they haven't got physical collateral for loans, but the training they weren't doing enough of. So it wasn't just the kind of metal bashing industries, high level metal bashing, but we also took on board some of the key service sectors as well. And so that's how I saw industrial strategy. And although Javid, my successor, went through the motions of saying this is terrible kind of cable leftist nonsense, but actually privately, I met him several times, he said, well, actually we're continuing to do so when Greg came in, the new minister, who was fully signed up to all this anyway, they've just kept it
there. They kept going.
The big weakness, sorry, I've been rather rambling on, but the big weakness in the stuff I was doing, which I think this government are addressing, whether they're solving it, I don't know, is the geographical dimension, which of course is your area.
Indeed.
Because we never really linked up the sectoral and horizontal stuff in what was happening in devolved, you know, these new combined authorities. And perhaps it was a totally different universe. And that was a big weakness. That's, you know, scope for somebody to do something creative.
Well, great. We'll maybe get some thoughts from you on that as we get into the conversation. Louise, give us a sense as to industrial strategy, how Nesta kind of thinks about this.
Yeah, so I think, you know, Vince Cable's right that this is a continuation of policies that have been put in place over the last successive administrations, but it's nice to see it front and centre. In some ways, it almost felt like it was having to be tucked slightly behind the curtain some of the time. You know, yes, we want to support these sectors, but we can't say we're spending money on businesses. We can't.
Yeah.
Everything's too much about austerity and other messages, and it sort of got lost in between. So it's nice to see it as a sort of central piece of government policy that they are advocating it and they're really getting some energy behind it. But I think the continuation is really helpful that a lot of these industries, especially the ones we really want to apply, like things like aerospace, having stability in approach is really helpful, and that we're not going to kind of revolutionise it and reinvent the wheel is really helpful. It's also encouraging to see innovation, and Vince was right to pull apart the science versus innovation thing, which often got blurred. You know, a lot of innovation announcements under some previous governments have actually really been science investments, which is, science investments are great, but they're not the same as an innovation investment. Mm. And actually, there does seem to be a lot of innovation at the heart of this strategy, which we're really excited to see. I think that geographical dimension is key to unlocking the innovation part of this, and trying to sort of connect these kind of slightly patchwork of different geographical structures that we now have in place between the devolved regions, the local enterprise partnerships, the various city deals going on.
Mm.
There's a lot of different pieces of the puzzle to try and connect there, but try to figure out how those can be usefully put together to get a much better sense of local needs, local growth, whilst not being completely disconnected from the kind of national priorities, right? The some of the failures of the RDAs around having too many centres of excellence in the same thing in too many places are not things that are worth replicating. But we have lost a lot of that infrastructure that you need to sense what are the local skills needs, how do we support local networks of businesses, and businesses do work in sectors and local networks and supply chains. A lot of that just sensing network of what's going on has been lost.
Yeah.
Building that back up is going to be really important, just to know what's going on.
Mm.
And having a better feedback loop then to say, okay, here's a policy we're trying out. How is it working? What can we adapt and change? And some of those feedback loops have been quite slow going because there isn't necessarily a good communications route to come back.
Mm.
Some of the industry councils have been a great conduit for those, but we could do some regional vehicles for that kind of feedback as well, I think.
Mm. Gavin, throw in your thoughts on the industrial strategy, but also I wonder whether, you know, Vince and Louise said this is a continuation of previous, and the 1970s and the 19 always seems to loom large. You know, I was reading one of your former speeches, and you started by reminding us that this would be different than the current green paper says. This will be somehow in some ways different.
Yes.
How will it be different?
Well, I think it will be a good thing when we get past the point where politicians feel the need to start all their speeches by saying that this is the 1970s. I think that will be a sign of progress. And I don't say, I mean, that's a cheap shot in a way, but it's a serious point. And we've had a 30-year cringe about industrial strategy in this country, and it's been unhelpful. During that 30 years, we've been doing some very good things, some less good things, which actually would now be called industrial policy or industrial strategy. But we had 30 years where we sort of did this dance where we pretended we weren't doing certain things and so on. And I agree with what's been said in terms of continuity. It's a good thing, and we should say this, it's a good thing that Peter Mandelson built on something that was already happening, but he developed them in interesting ways, and he was a supreme master at telling a narrative about putting things together in a way which was quite compelling. And Vince came in and built on that, as he said. And that's, you know, there's too few areas where sensible policy is developed across administrations. I think this was one. I think pensions is another. There's lots of areas where people do gesture change, and that didn't happen. So that's a good thing. But I do think we can't have this discussion outside of the wider context for it. Otherwise, it's kind of very partial. And the wider context is, I think, some interesting and positive policy development that Vince has sketched out, against the backdrop of, and this kind of spanned different administrations, so it's not a party point, of a kind of profoundly bad productivity story, which I think we're all familiar with, a profoundly depressing story about business investment and R&D, and a depressing story about kind of growth across different regions and so on. So we've got, and that's before we get into skills and our long-running sort of underperformance there, which goes back to the mid-Victorian era in terms of technical skills and so on. So we've got these kind of entrenched issues. Some bits of our economy are performing very well and so on. I'm not trying to just be bleak about this, but in terms of, you know, issues which touch directly on industrial policy, we've got some policy, I think, success and some sensible institution building alongside these very, very deep challenges, which I think is incredibly important. And the other bit of context, which I think runs right across, if you like, the 20th century story of industrial policy, is this tension between policy seeking to help frontier firms and frontier regions, if you like, which we've had various episodes of, and then something else, which often gets called industrial policy, but is really what we used to call regional policy, although we sort of don't use that phrase so much anymore, which is policy about helping places and indeed some sectors which are in some sense defensive and on the back foot and declining. And quite often governments kind of try and sweep those two things together. And I think the Labour government did that in the 2000s. And I think if you actually read the current Green paper, they do that too. Perhaps understandably, but we need to unpack these things because the way in which policy is constructed, the way in which the Treasury thinks about where money goes in terms of public money and so on, is there's a certain sort of logic to that which predisposes certain sorts of decisions to be made, which bias money towards some areas and against others, which we can unpack. But the point is, you know, that's how Whitehall thinks about these things. So we can't sort of pretend that the policy is going to be somehow geographically agnostic, because it's not.
I think one of the strengths of this paper is it is so big and broad, and it just has tried very hard to look
at people sort of trying to do it all.
Right? It's very hard to say, look, they've obviously missed this huge
area. They did that well.
But they've done that well. But at the same time, it's trying to cover so many goals. They're trying to raise.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that a strategy,
I think,
or is that just a.
And for something that they're really putting at the front and centre of government, it's a good thing. I think the danger, as Gavin said, is that you confuse those aims. And you try and do those things with the same policy at the same time. And the support for emerging technologies for radical change is different than support for the vast breadth of businesses to raise overall productivity levels, and is different from policies that you might use to address regional growth issues. And by if you try to aim into a policy at doing multiple of those things at once, the chances of you hitting all of them are much slimmer. Mm. So I think To take all those issues seriously is helpful, but they need to be clear about which policies are suitable for which of those goals.
Mm. Vince, you talked a little bit about squeamish nature of some of your political colleagues around industrial strategy, but I mean, you've been around these sorts of issues for, you know, a long time. How does the UK compare around our thinking compared to some of our counterparts, either in Europe or other parts of the globe? Nordics are often, you know, highlighted,
well,
Finland and others, or the US.
Gavin calls this 30-year cringe, and I think it's actually quite a good way of putting it. Actually, the first book I ever wrote, published, was after I worked with John Smith in the Department of Trade in 1979, which we called Protectionism and Industrial Decline, and it was one of the earlier gasps of the cringe, really. We had all these Neddy and little Neddies and support for the textile industry that was obviously going nowhere, at least at that point. And I think that so dominated our thinking, and in a very negative way. And actually, the Damascus conversion amongst all my right-wing Tory colleagues in the coalition was when I tried to introduce this, there was initial, we did all this, we Tony Benn and all that. But it was William Hague spoke up, who's a pretty free market sort of guy. He said, well, actually, look, every big decision we make in government, the default position is a form of industrial strategy. If we decide, you know, to procure a tanker from Middlesbrough rather than Korea, that is an industrial policy decision.
Yeah.
So let's be explicit about it.
Yeah.
Let's not try and pretend that these things are all determined on our behalf. So I think that was the point at which it broke through. Your point about comparative experience. I'm working with a group in the London School of Economics, which we're actually dealing with international comparative industrial strategy.
Right.
Because this is sort of coming back internationally, not just in the UK, because although we had a 30-year cringe in the UK, so did the rest of the world, actually.
Right.
Because there was the whole of that World Bank consensus that swept away, you know, planning departments and all that kind of thing in Africa, Asia, Latin America, you know, often for very good reasons. But they, you know, anything that smacked of industrial policy was immediately jumped on by, you know, bank IMF economists as complete crap and belonging to the ancient history.
Yeah.
And, but in the last few years, it's sort of re-emerging. And there are one or two kind of role models that people keep coming back to, one of which is Korea, obviously, Finland, not so much the other Nordic countries, which are more, that don't sort of do planning or sectoral stuff. But so we're trying to create a theoretical as well as a kind of policy framework for applying this kind of modern approach to industrial policy internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Mariana have been very helpful in this. You know her work at, in Sussex.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, she has a particular ideological angle, but she's right, actually, that, you know, in many respects, some of the really big innovation breakthroughs have been led by government.
Yeah, and she makes the point, you said, about market making as much as market solving or market failures, doesn't she?
Right.
Says that market failure is not a sufficient framework to think about a modern industrial policy.
Chang's stuff on Korea is a very simple common sense stuff, but it's right. And I think people are beginning to perk up and see that that this long cringe is
not helpful.
Not helpful, and we've come to an end of it.
Yeah.
And it's just what you're putting in its place.
As Vince says, during this period, we were, of course, William Hague was saying, making decisions which actually, in some ways, did create markets as well. I mean, it's often used as an example, but I think, you know, the Jubilee Line extension was a kind of fantastically vivid example of the government sort of physically and metaphorically, you know, creating a new path for the, for a powerful bit of the economy. It wasn't a new, it wasn't a new sector, it was an established sector, but it was kind of led to a renaissance of that sector and opened up geographically a whole growth corridor that we all know about. But that was a dramatic bit of public policy making. But then another high profile one, you know, just if you think about the BBC in Manchester. I mean, this isn't so much picking, you know, you're not picking winners, but you're placing bets.
You're taking
options. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is not a kind of neutral, you're making, you know, and Manchester courted that. That wasn't a kind of accidental, you know, for a long time they courted that, and that was a big decision, and I think most people would say it's paid off incredibly well for them.
Yeah.
So these decisions, in any world of government, in a mixed economy, choices will be made.
Yeah.
Which create new spaces for local economies or sectors or so on. The question is, what sort of framework do you put around it and how strategic are you?
So I think this phrase, picking winners, which we all look at the heyday of this negative thinking,
we all kind of
used in a very pejorative way, actually proved to be very, very unhelpful, generally. Because, you know, businesses are picking winners all the time. I was in one of the world's biggest oil companies, and, you know, we would make a decision that we wanted, you know, a refinery in China that would be there for the next 30 to 40 years. I mean, you're not forecasting, and you're not, but you have to make a decision. Otherwise, why didn't you just sell the company and give it all back to the shareholders?
So
companies may pick winners. Governments have got to have a mechanism for doing it, which isn't politicised, which isn't crony capitalism, but nonetheless is necessary.
Louise, pick up on this point Gavin started to introduce around, you know, should we be thinking as more about those at the frontier, either the people, the places, or the sectors or the industries, or should we be looking at addressing the laggards, the long tail, in the sense of trying to bring more of those up to the average or closer to the average? I guess, you know, the classic answer, the politician's answer is, oh no, we can do all of this, right? I mean, you know, you get that kick and eat it springs to mind. But just give us a sense as to how we might think about those sorts of things, or where are we on that?
So I think actually in terms of the frontier stuff, actually, that a lot of the policy that has been put in place over the last sort of 5 or 10 years has been actually very supportive of doing that, and things like you know, the kind of frontier developments in things like the automotive industry, you know, the self-driving car work that's been done here, the test beds and the pilot schemes that are running now, the work the Innovate UK has been doing has been quite good at supporting that. There is still some work to be done on, particularly on really emerging industries that haven't really got a good constituency you can go and deal with. How do you deal with something like machine intelligence, which is distributed across any number of different types of sectors and firms and could have quite a pervasive impact? So some of those things we still haven't got a good handle on, but those are so new that it's almost, you can't set it in a strategy in place for that. You just have to have a dialogue with those. And I think that that is starting to emerge through things like the Turing Institute. So I think actually if you're going to focus energy on anything, I would focus probably on the laggards. It's probably not what the Innovation Agency should be saying, but actually the frontier stuff, we have got some fairly good stuff in place and supporting and encouraging that, and probably using better information, better data about what is out there, what is emerging, what have we got genuine capability and expertise in against other places in the world, is a good way to support that stuff. But we have some useful mechanisms in place. Innovate UK has some good programs. Biomedical catapult system is there. We have things like biomedical catalysts, which actually very rarely for the British system fuse together the ability to fund academics and industry in the same pot. We have too few of those pots where it's open to both sides, and those are really helpful for those really kind of frontier areas. The laggards is the big problem when you're talking about the economy as a whole, talking about productivity, when you're talking about sort of regional growth, getting the breadth of businesses who want to grow and scale to grow and scale. Some research we did with NISA on productivity suggested that even during the period of growth before the financial crisis, British business as a whole was bad at allocating resources to the highest productivity firms. So high productivity firms were improving and lower productivity firms also improved, but there was such a big loss from not allocating more resource towards the high productivity ones, not allowing them to grow as fast as they could. It's not really unclear exactly what the drivers were.
No, quite.
But there are so many businesses that want to grow, that want to add new things to their repertoire, that want to add innovation into what they're doing, and the number of resources they've got to turn to has really decreased. We had the RDAs, we had things like manufacturing advisory services, the growth accelerator. A lot of those programs were the ones that kind of lost out in the last comprehensive spending review. So I think looking again at some of those programs, probably looking at what is the kind of different local needs and trying to get some better feedback on what is actually in demand in those places would be really helpful in terms of raising the overall level.
Yeah, and that's not just about finance. I mean, Vince mentioned this earlier on about different forms of finance, whether it's smaller pots of VC or more patient rather than typical, the way that VC often runs. But it's not only finance, the way that you were describing it then. It's sort of technical, managerial development support as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is always a debate to be had about finance. I think we've been in worse places in terms of finance for the business. I think that there's always something that you can look at. But actually, a lot has been done in the last few years to improve matters there. I don't think we're in as bad a place as we were. I think the biggest gap is in terms of the business networks, the business advice, the support to do things like knowledge transfer partnerships, which over and over again get evaluated as being, you know, incredibly good value. It's still such a small scheme to take graduates, to take postgraduates from universities who have some specific knowledge into businesses. They get a better knowledge of the business gets some really useful research capability. Over and over again, this gets really highly rated and it pays back a lot to the business to adopt it. It's still so timely. Some of that kind of capability and the ability to try to look at new processes to give some support to trying things out that otherwise businesses are a bit risk averse for doing. And you know, any number of studies look at the management capability in Britain and say that we've got a really good
long tail of gap. Vince, laggards, frontiers, all.
Yes, no, I think the points you just made are right. The big picture stuff, I think, is in more or less the right place. But the point that the CBI kept making, they produced a very influential study in about 2011-12 about gazelles.
Yeah.
That there's a small number of companies that are very productive and grow very fast, but we're just terribly deficient in that area compared with Germany, if you compare like with like. And we tried to address this, and sadly, and I won't be getting into scoring political points, but the best programme we had was this thing called the Growth Accelerator, which they promptly scrapped in 2015 because some 16-year-old in the Treasury thought this was a waste of money, and it just overnight. And that's the kind of silliness that we... And that's why, in a way, I think your introductory point about diffusing this stuff to decentralized units of government is probably
the way to
create
do
some
it.
More durable structure. Mm. Because as long as everything's centralized, you may
yeah,
have some things,
yeah.
but
yeah.
you know, somebody you know gets out of bed on the wrong side
and away it goes. Yeah. Yeah. Gavin, get some thoughts on this laggard versus frontier sort of question or challenge. Can we do both realistically, honestly?
Well, I think, as you say, the temptation is always to say
yes.
do both. I think I mean, my prejudice, and it is that really, is that the companies at the frontiers are much just better placed to look after themselves, and B, politicians are generally like to sort of support them and be with them and so on. That's kind of where the action tends
yeah.
to be.
Yeah.
And I think we've actually done quite well at creating some supportive infrastructure around those companies, and I think that's the right thing to do, and countries need vanguards, otherwise they don't get anywhere. I think we've been much weaker at what's sometimes called a kind of large pedestrian service sort of part of the mass employing part of our economy. If you just look across some of the obvious examples of retail, hospitality, distribution, food processing, just where a lot of people work. And it's just, you have to just ask the question, what would your industrial strategy be? I mean, the words don't even work.
That's quite an important point. I just wondered whether to challenge, because one of the decisions I made was to keep all those sectors out of the industrial because they're non-traded.
Mostly non-traded, not all of them are non-traded, but I think we perform incredibly badly, even on relative to other countries in those sectors in terms of labour productivity. I don't know whether this should be... I'm not even making a case that this should be front and centre of the government's industrial strategy. I am making the case that we have a big problem in this sector. And it isn't just... people will say, well, that's why we have apprenticeships, and we can have a whole discussion about apprenticeships, but that just is not the answer to the problem I'm describing, or certainly not the full answer, because we have chronically bad management in many of those sectors. Of course, we have some great firms as well, but we have some really, really bad... management, particularly the kind of mid-level, has been study after study after that. We've got terrible utilisation of skills within the workforce. And that's a kind of persistent feature which doesn't seem to be self-correcting in a number of sectors. It's hard for government. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Whitehall and I slightly wince at the idea of the team which is going to tell the retail sector how to manage... better, and but I actually do think that is a very, very big problem. And in terms of our labour productivity numbers, that's where a lot of the issue lies. If we made a 0.25% difference to labour productivity in those sectors, then you're talking real progress. So I think that is one big issue that if you're trying to talk about kind of the geography of how this plays out, you can't sort of ignore that sort of stuff. And the other issue I'll just put on the table at this point is. Just how, which is in some ways slightly more tractable, although still very hard, is how the public, how Whitehall, how the public sector thinks about where it invests. And if you like, the current sort of technology, if you like, for how we think about that when you're sat in the centre of government, you have your sort of standard cost-benefit analysis and so on. And the way in which we deploy that will overwhelmingly tilt you towards incremental investments in high productivity, high growth, locations, not exclusively, and there'll be some exceptions to that and so on, but that is overwhelmingly what comes out the other end of the equation.
Well, you drew the Jubilee line rather than the line between Leeds and Manchester, don't you?
Leeds and Manchester
it's a slightly different one,
but you overwhelmingly you do Croydon, you do it's not just like, I mean, you do London and you put and in terms of where you're going to locate a new publicly funded institution,
yeah.
you overwhelmingly like to be in the southeast somewhere. And that is, and there's some good reasons for that. And if you throw that all out the window, then that has consequences too. But if you don't grapple with that logic,
yeah.
then you're always going to end up with the picture looking roughly like it looks like today, and you might incrementally change it, but it will be at the margins. And that is a massive issue to debate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally agree. I think this public investment issue is at the heart of a lot of our problems.
Right.
I mean, I think my own government was criminally incompetent in dealing with public sector investment. We inherited a bad policy and we left one behind. We could have been doing much more public investment, borrowing at virtually zero rates of interest and just getting on with it, but the Treasury would not allow it. It regards current spending and capital spending as the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, So there's that there was that big issue, just lack of public investment. And I think the second point is within public investment, you have this, you know, and I guess this is the nature of democratic politics, this enthusiasm for grand projet rather than you know, things that produce high economic and social rates of return. There was a very good report in the Brown era by a man called Eddington, who was head of the airports or something.
Yep.
And he made the point that almost all of the high yielding public sector projects are small and inconspicuous. And if you really wanted to do something sensible now, you'd go to the Network Rail Plan. You wouldn't be doing these mega things. So the issue of public investment, scale of an allocation within the public sector investment portfolio, that is a major area of problems.
But I wonder in your time as Secretary of State, Vincent, you raised it about, you know, how you grappled with, you know, the place element of, or the geography element of the decisions that you were making on an industrial strategy, you know, perspective. Because as Gavin said, Louise said, you know, if you were doing excellence in R&D or science, you would be going to Oxford, Cambridge and London. You know, on all things being equal, you would be reinforcing those centres of excellence. But if you're thinking about, you know, a geographical rebalance or, you know, a broader perspective, then you would be having to make deliberate decisions to go to Manchester or Leeds or, you know, wherever else. And I don't know, it just gives us
a... That's a very good question, and some of my fiercest battles in government were over exactly that question. Just a quick one or two examples. The allocation of catapults was decided by a kind of objective, non-ministerial thing. But it was obvious to me from the outset that if you just let that happen, they would all come to London and Oxford again. So I interviewed myself, very unpopular, and insisted that several of them went into the frozen tundra beyond. But there was one that was never resolved. I mean, the fights were so bitter, which was over stratified medicine.
Right.
And I said, you know, we had a kind of competition between all these regional centres for it. And I said, well, look, all the, you know, if you put a bit of a weighting on regional development, you should go to Manchester. And Osborne pitched in and said, yeah. But the establishment would not allow it.
Right.
All the professors were going to write to the Times and outrage, and this should be at Oxford because this is where this is done best. It may well be. But we eventually finished that with a kind of dog's breakfast. It was sort of scattered between several places, including Belfast.
Right.
But that kind of thing goes on the whole time.
Yeah. And that goes to the heart of issues, really, about making some choices or making some preferences about what it is we're trying to achieve. And, you know, you used your previous employer, Shell, as an example. They didn't invest in China without any idea as to what it is they were trying to achieve. You know, clarity of purpose is the defining thing, and it seems to me that clarity of purpose means some tough choices have to be made, and, you know, politicians try not to do that. Not all, but some.
Yeah, and you were inheriting this idea of excellence, which is a great credo for allocating science funding, but the effect of that has been, through the science budget, to reinforce these centres of excellence, which get more and more concentrated, and it's harder and harder to break into those, and there's a real question about an emerging discipline, an emerging area which is growing rapidly. And what access does that have to funds? What abilities that has to break through as something that preserves past excellence and historic excellence? And that's a kind of battle that the structures around higher education are constantly wrestling with, is how do we try and allow room for the interdisciplinary stuff, the emerging sectors, the different kind of approaches where we're trying to also trying to promote excellence. When it comes to further down the kind of development spectrum, this linear process, but away from science more into development and innovation, then there should be much more of a dimension, which is where are the businesses, where's the potential for growth, where is the infrastructure, where's the housing, where are the job needs, and that really should be taken a part in the decision making. And I think Vince was right to say that this isn't a purely, you know, where is the purest excellence to be found. Some of this excellence will move. It's kind of odd that you think in the US you think very little about moving from Philadelphia to California to Austin to pursue a job. In the UK, people are kind of terribly afraid that nobody's going to move from Leeds to Manchester or vice versa. Certainly not from London to anywhere else, heaven forbid. You know, we really don't consider mobility in this country to be a, you know, possibility a lot of the time. I think actually there's generational change potentially happening as London gets less and less affordable. this concentration produces a greater concentration of wealth. People increasingly are moving out, and that is going to create more capacity to create these different kind of pockets of specialism and of industry in different places. That's probably starting to happen, but the government's got a big role to play. These decisions about investment are going to be made. If we want a centre of knowledge around a particular type of technology, it's helpful to have it in one place and not with 9 satellites. Where does that leave you?
I mean, there's an interesting phenomenon happening, which I'm sure you're studying in Nesto, which are these clusters of you know, creative industries and IT, you know, places like Dundee and Newcastle or so on, and there are about 20 of them.
Yeah.
And I think the policy question is, are these real, or are these just a kind of dumbed down smaller version of what's happening in Tech City in London? Are they real, and what should government or decentralised government be doing to get them really motoring? But it is happening.
There's a fair point would be Whitehall is not the best place to think about those sorts of, I mean, it goes back to where we, you know, the implementation, or not least dealing with information asymmetries and problems around, you know, do we know enough in order to, I mean, but if thinking about whether Dundee or Newcastle are real and how we support them is probably not decisions to be made from Whitehall.
But there are better ways of interrogating those questions than, you know, literally getting on the train and visiting them. There's no substitute for that. But, you know, we can, you know, we've been looking a lot with the Welsh Government at different ways of examining those questions and looking at these clusters. You know, where are people advertising jobs? Look, scraping online job adverts. Which skills are people recruiting for where? Can you get the sense of which industries are growing in which places from who's advertising for what skills? Can you find out where people are self-organising meetups around a technology to discover if there's a real pocket of interest in a place about a new topic? So there are now better ways of getting at that kind of knowledge and trying to compare different places. There's still no substitute for the conversation with the industry and the people who are there and working on it to see what's happening. But we don't necessarily have to sit back and rely on an ONS sort of industry structure that gives us detail about, you know, manufacturing of margarine, but it's completely unable to tell you anything about, you know, renewable energy. You know, some of those kind of economic statistics aren't very helpful when you try and get at these kind of questions. But there are other ways of attacking that kind of information.
But is it your impression, though, that having Scottish Enterprise, which is, you know, the one big decentralised thing that we've got, actually makes a big difference in promoting the clusters around Dundee or Glasgow? Or you might as well just be in Middlesbrough?
I think it does in some industries. The Scottish Enterprise will pick and choose, like any of these innovation agencies around the world, which sectors, industries they really focus on. So I think for some it really does. I think actually almost for people like, you know, the Dundee and kind of video games cluster, it's more helpful to be connected internationally than it is necessarily to be promoted by Scottish Enterprise on any particular dimension. But certainly, you know, the Scottish Enterprise take a very different approach on this stuff in terms of knowing who the individual businesses are and who's growing and who should be connecting and where should they be trade, you know, who should be on which trade mission and who could do with a call from who, you know, so that they've got that almost account management level of, you know, who's needs what at our sectors and who's
well,
really
hopefully, you know, when Manchester Leeds get moving and their enterprise hubs, so this kind of thing will happen in England.
One of the concerns, I think, Gavin, get your thought on, you start us off on this issue about wasting money, in the sense of government not being sufficiently placed. It would, you know, if we borrowed and invest, we would waste a lot of money. I mean, the important point there, I think you were saying earlier on, is you have to take into consideration where we start from. Go on, say a little bit more about that.
If you work in government, you're constantly on the kind of, one line of attack that you're kind of familiar with is, if you back a certain project, then what if it's a kind of white elephant, and what if your public money goes into something and you get a bad story? And that is a absolutely legitimate and valid sort of thing to worry about, and of course value for money is crucial. But the context for which we're having debate on industrial strategy is also crucial, which is, we are a country which invests incredibly small amounts relative to lots of other people, and interest rates are rock bottom. And so that you have to balance off the risk that you back something with public funds, which goes nowhere, against the risk that you're missing out and your kids are going to miss out on all sorts of innovation, creation, use of tech and so on, because you didn't make the investment. And at the moment, I think any rational discussion would say that latter risk of not creating wealth, the wealth we will never see because we haven't invested, is just dramatically larger than the risks of, which are real, of making some bad choices. So of course you have to sort of always spend wisely, and you have to worry about making the right, you know, your systems for making the right choices and so on. But strategically, you know, we are standing, we start from a position where we're, in terms of R&D and so on, we're about half the level of Germany in terms of business investment, and public investment is well down compared to the OECD average. So we really, the strategic direction is very clear. We need to invest an awful lot more. We need to try and manage that as best we can. But the biggest risk facing us is not investing enough rather than getting it wrong.
Vince, how do we, how, as being on the inside receiving those calls, how do we, what do we need to do to win those arguments? Are they arguments to be won?
Because we lost the argument.
Yeah.
You know, this argument that it all adds to debt, you know, rather than return on
investment.
That argument has been lost, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. Hopefully, it will be turned around. I've been doing a paper for the LSE recently on how you make public investment more acceptable again. And I think to deal with Gavin's problem about the dud projects, you do need some mechanism where these things are sort of vetted outside of a political context. And you know, you've got the Infrastructure Commission, which is a very, in some ways a very good model. But if a lot of the things we're talking about, you know, a decision to invest £1 billion in the car industry, were to go through the same sort of filter, rather than, you know, just happens to be my pet enthusiasm of the week, then that would restore a bit of credibility. I mean, obviously, you're going to create lots and lots of tears because that just slows everything down. But you do need some mechanism, and I think the Infrastructure Commission is quite a good model.
Well, we start to draw to a close. I can't leave you go without just getting your reflections on how you think Brexit, particularly, I think Brexit in the context of, you know, competition, export, international trade being important factors in producing more productive economies, how, you know, that might affect the industrial strategy and our thinking about the economy. Gavin? Well,
I'll just go on. Make one point before the others jump in, which I think has been under-discussed, and it's one of the number of reasons that I'm worried about both the single market and the customs union from a British point of view, which is, I think we've been insulated in a very positive way from some difficult politics over the last generation that we've been a member of the single market, because the single market and the issues of customs unions and trade deals have largely taken place somewhere else, if you like. Of course, you know, British groups lobby Brussels and so on, but by and large, that's not been a central feature in the discussion about the shape of our industrial policy. And that's going to change dramatically, because we are now going to be in a world where we're signing, hopefully signing, bilateral trade deals with all sorts of people. And those trade deals are all going to have trade-offs within them. And some sectors are going to be hurt by them, some sectors will gain, some regions will win, some regions will lose. Ditto nations within the United Kingdom. And that is going to be, when that becomes more apparent, that is going to be tremendously contentious. And we will see a kind of zero-sum lobbying politics about the nature of those trade deals and which areas or sectors are going to win and lose, which we've been relatively, and our politicians have been relatively insulated from, because we've had this thing called the single market and we've had this thing called the customs union, and most of our politicians don't spend most of their time dealing with that. They do with other things. And I think that's been a positive thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's been a good thing, because I don't necessarily like the look of where the politics goes when you have different regions lobbying hard, as they will, rightly, to defend their interest in a nascent trade deal with another nation. And I think that is where a lot of energy is going to be.
Louise, how do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's everyone's guess at this point. Nestor, every year we do predictions for the year ahead, and 2016 and 2017 have been a very difficult year to be doing in that business. But, I mean, the thing I think we should be kind of keeping on is standards and regulation for a lot of emerging industries and emerging technologies. It's actually quite helpful to be a place where you are constructing emerging standards that raise up the quality of the industry. We've seen it with things like crowdfunding and peer-to-peer lending in the UK, where we're leading Europe. We've seen it with things like self-driving cars If we start to cut those back and go to the lowest common denominator, it may not. It may win us things in the short term, and it may cause a lot of damage to those kind of emerging technologies where we could actually be leading the way by setting a higher standard for what could be done.
I agree with what's been said. I've got to speak in Liverpool next Monday, so you're helping me right, Mark.
That's good to know.
You just posed. Ah. And the way I was starting to approach it was to say, well, forget about the fact that I'm a dogmatic remainer. Let's just assume that it's happening and that it's a good thing.
Yeah.
What are the things we could do that we can't do at the moment for industrial strategy? And actually, it's quite a long list. I mean, you can start spending lots more money without state aid stuff. You can do lots more anti-dumping measures if you don't like steel and ceramics and all those things. You can start biasing your public procurement to your domestic industries, if that's what you want to do. And most seriously of all, and I think the area where I'm not just being devil's advocate, I am a devil, actually, which is to believe that we could make takeovers much more restrictive.
Right.
And have public interest tests on science-based industries or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of things that you could do in a Brexit world on industrial strategy that you're not allowed to do at the moment. But the great irony about all this is that because none of these things have been advocated by the Brexiteers in government.
No.
And they're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, very good, very good. My guests today have been Right Honourable Sir Vince Cable, Gavin Kelly and Louise Marston. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.